Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this morning. We're going to be talking about fair elections. And I'll just give you a heads up, a reminder about the next couple of weeks. First of all, thank you for finding your way here to us this morning. If you know of anybody who missed it, of course, we are on WCNY FM. We are broadcast on Sunday at 8 p.m. and then podcast sometime thereafter at WCNY.org. So next week, we're going to continue with our election series. We'll have Gene Conway and Toby Shelley. They are the two candidates for Onondaga County Sheriff. So they're both new to us, so you might want to, you know, check into some newspaper articles or websites and formulate some good questions for them. Grant Reher will be moderating that program. The following week, October, week in October, we will have John Katko and Dan Maffei, again moderated by Professor Reher. Once again, two candidates for the 24th Congressional District. Not everybody necessarily lives in that district, but you might want to think about some good questions for them as well. So that's the next couple of weeks. Today we're going to be hearing from Susan Lerner. Susan is the Executive Director of Common Cause New York. She joined Common Cause New York in December of 2007. It's an organization that is a good government organization, right? Civics and all of that, and very often has the same goals as some of our other organizations, like the League of Women Voters. We've talked about other good government organizations. We had the Brennan Report people and all of that. Most often, they have common goals and also common perspectives on things. In this case, or at least in one of the issues we're going to be talking about today, the redistricting proposal, League of Women Voters, Common Cause, not so much. So on your tables, I've asked the League of Women Voters to give you some information on their side of the story. League of Women Voters of Greater Syracuse will also be doing a session next week, I believe, at the Liverpool Library on Tuesday. Is that right, Joan? 5 o'clock, Liverpool Library on October 21st. All right. So there you'll hear from them another side of the story. But for today, again, just a little bit more. Founded in 1970, Common Causes sparked a democracy reform movement that grows. They have offices in 35 states, members in all 50 states. Common Cause New York is dedicated to this is from their website, dedicated to restoring the core values of American democracy and reinventing an open, honest, and accountable government. Their issue areas include money in politics, ethics, redistricting, voting and elections, and the media industry and democracy. So if you would, join me in welcoming Susan Lerner. Thank you for coming today. Thanks.
Well, first I would like to thank Sandra and Colleen for having me, and I am very pleased to be here, and I wish that there were more cities that had organizations like the Thursday Morning Roundtable. I found out about it from Assemblymember Sterpe, and I have been watching the topics that you discuss, and it's really an impressive idea, and it's really exciting to see so many people on a topic like campaign finance and redistricting, whereas you know hordes of screaming teenagers show up every time that we're speaking on this topic. Unfortunately, it's hard to get people to focus on these, on the real workings of our government and the important principles and aspects which influence our elections. Right now, unfortunately, we are in a time of great cynicism. And I'm going to talk to you this morning, unfortunately, about some things that have been happening in Albany which feed that cynicism. And we see that, and unfortunately we're going to see that, I believe, on November 4th, where, again, New York is going to unfortunately have a very low turnout. We predict reluctantly for elections. So while Sandra said you're going to be picking up the discussion of elections in your next session, I'd like to suggest to you that this actually is a part of your discussions regarding elections, because I want to talk to you about two topics which have an impact on how people regard elections and their willingness to become involved, either as candidates or as voters. And so we're going to be talking first about campaign finance reform and then talk a little bit about redistricting and the proposal that is on the ballot in November. I've titled this talk Putting Voters First, because I believe that that is the goal that we all should have when we're looking at anything which impacts our elections, and certainly when we're talking about campaign finance and redistricting. There we go. So, campaign finance. Is there a problem? I think most people would say yes. I think most people would say that currently our elections are too expensive to run, that there is way too much money, that the money creates a pay-to-play atmosphere. It discourages ordinary citizens from being willing to run. If you talk to somebody who's civically inclined, and perhaps some of you here have had the conversation where somebody says, you would be a great candidate for fill in the blank, why don't you run? The first conversation is, how much money would I need to raise? And can I raise that much amount of money? And do I want to spend all of my time raising that amount of money? Our elections have become extraordinarily expensive. There are a lot of reasons for that, which we can go into another time, because what I want to get to is not so much the problem, which I think pretty much most people agree there is a problem, too much money in our elections. I want to talk today about a solution. So we have too much money. We have, as a consequence, not enough representation, not because we aren't electing people who don't want to be our representatives or who aren't inclined to spend the time, but because at the state and the federal level, sometimes at the local level, so much of their time has to be spent in raising money to keep putting out the ads, putting out the mailers. And not enough time spent with local people and with local problems. Because, unfortunately, what we see over and over and over again is the large amounts of campaign money comes from special interests in Albany and in New York City. Less of the money is raised locally, certainly for national, for the congressional, and often the state races. Whoops. Okay. This just gives you an idea of the amount of money that we're talking about. And 2012, is not a gubernatorial year. It's simply legislative races. We didn't have any statewide races, and yet $85 million was spent solely on the legislative races. And the most expensive races will spend over $1 million or more, and then outside spenders will spend at least that much and sometimes more, and that's a whole other problem. But when you look at who is providing the money, what you find is it's a very, very small percentage of New Yorkers. Most New Yorkers are not inclined to contribute. And if you talk to ordinary voters and you say, have you supported the candidate that you like with your dollars, they will say, my $25, my $50, even my $100 doesn't matter very much. So no, most New Yorkers do not support candidates financially. They may volunteer, but not writing checks. And so close to 99.51% of New Yorkers are not contributing. And the pie chart, that was a little cue to myself, and it should have gone out, because here's the pie chart. And really the important thing, and now let's see if I can get this to work. This is exciting. There's a pointer. Yes, this is the key segment, because that is the amount of campaign contributions that are $250 or less, the amount that most ordinary New Yorkers would be able to contribute. That's just barely above 10%. The rest of this pie chart represents larger donations. And it's this segment, which is the biggest segment, represents donations of over $10,000 or more. Most people are not able to write a $10,000 check. For some people, that represents a very hefty slice of their income. And when you look at the high campaign contribution limits, in New York, we have unusually high campaign contribution limits. It is possible for an individual to write a check of over $60,000 to a gubernatorial candidate, and that is higher than the median income for New Yorkers. So the fact that you can write these really large checks discourages the smaller giver from participating financially. There's something called the LLC loophole, fairly technical, but it's basically a way in which an individual can aggregate the amount of money that they give to a candidate to go beyond that already high $60,000 threshold. And we have individuals who've used this loophole to give over $1 million to a gubernatorial candidate. That kind of influence and access is something our campaign finance laws are designed to discourage, and yet we have this loophole in the law, something we're trying to close. And also, we have a phenomenon that allows the political parties to raise literally limitless amounts of money for something called housekeeping accounts, which are a good idea, and they're supposed to help parties continue the activities the party should be engaged in. They're not supposed to be used for supporting candidates, and that is a problem that we face. Again, when ordinary voters see these kinds of sky-high limits, the ability for wealthy special interests to write limitless checks, they're discouraged. But we do have an alternative. And that is a system that we call fair elections. It's a system that helps local residents support local candidates. It helps small businesses participate without having to worry about breaking the bank. It limits impact of super rich contributors. And it gives candidates another path, a way in which to focus on their constituents and the small dollar donor. And the way in which it works is while it's, you know, is actually relatively simple in concept, it's about empowerment. It's about empowering the candidate to speak to voters, to spend their time talking to constituents and the people who will support them with their votes rather than special interests. And it's about providing options to candidates and to the public. So the way in which it works is it's a small dollar matching fund. Public money is provided to match small donations. And what we are recommending is a 6-to-1 match for contributions below $250. Some systems, it's a 6-to-1 match for contributions below $175. And it's a voluntary system. This is not something which candidates are required to participate in. It's an opt-in. A candidate has to show a base of support among constituents in order to take advantage of the public money. It's not just handed out willy-nilly to anybody, but it's something which a candidate that has a strong base of support would then be able to take advantage of. And an important part of the system, we believe, is lowering campaign contribution limits for all candidates. And what this means is that somebody who donates $100 to a candidate, their contribution is worth $700. So if you write a $100 check and it's worth $700 to the candidate, you're playing in a different league, to be honest. And it's very much an incentive for ordinary people to contribute. I believe that the key and the core of my presentation about the fair election system are these two maps. So I want to spend a little time explaining what they are, because I think they're very revelatory. This is a map of New York City, which has had a small donor matching fund system since the late 80s. And this is a map that's broken down by what are called census blocks, which are the basic unit that the U.S. Census uses to take the census. And each of the dark blocks represents a census block in New York City where there is at least one person who's made a financial contribution to the local candidate for state assembly. And as you can see, we've got a lot of blank space here. Many areas where there's absolutely nobody contributing anything to the person who is running, any of the candidates running for their state assembly. But we looked at the impact of the small dollar matching fund system by looking at those same census blocks and looking to see what kind of participation did we have financially in supporting city council candidates who were able to take advantage of the small dollar matching fund system. And this is what we found. This is a big contrast, friends. And what was most surprising to us, we expected to see some increase, maybe two or three times more, but particularly in disadvantaged minority neighborhoods, we were taken aback and quite frankly thrilled by what we found, because we found that in the traditionally underrepresented neighborhoods, there was a differential sometimes as high as 23 times more individuals participating financially supporting their city council members than they were supporting people who were running for assembly. And we believe that a significant part of that is the small dollar matching funds. Why do I believe that? Because there was a change in New York City's system about 6 years ago. It went from a 5-to-1 match for the first $250 to a 6-to-1 match for the first $175. 250 to me is sort of an even number. I can see somebody with substantial means sitting down and deciding to write a $250 check. Not a lot of people would decide, oh, the amount I'm going to go to naturally is $175. Before that switch, there were a significant number of $250 checks which city council members garnered. After the switch, there were virtually no more $250 checks, and almost all of the larger matching fund checks were $175, telling us that both the voters and the candidates were responsive to the system and that it actually influences how people behave. And that's why we've been advocating for a fair election system at the state level. But something interesting, and unfortunately I believe fairly cynical, happened this cycle. In response to a strong statewide push advocating for a fair elections matching fund system for statewide offices, a so-called pilot project was adopted as part of the budgeting process. And this was a very strange adoption, because it was a very limited system for only one office, very, very late, relatively speaking, in the election cycle. And some of you may be familiar with the fact that comptroller candidate Bob Antonacci, to his credit, has been trying to qualify for the matching funds that were created only for the comptroller's race and only for the six-month period in 2014. And we think, actually, that in order for a fair election system to work well and to be a benefit to the public for the money that's being provided, it needs to be properly calibrated. It needs to have the right ratio of matching fund to contribution. It needs to set spending limits for the participants correctly. It needs to bring down contribution limits for everybody. And it needs to have enough time in advance of the election for candidates to actually be able to qualify. And two out of those four elements that we believe from our experience around the country with public financing systems are not in the so-called pilot project. And as a consequence, we believe this isn't really a pilot project. It's not proving anything. It is showing that Bob Antonacci is a very game candidate who is doing his best to overcome the limitations that were built into the system. Not enough time for him to raise the necessary small dollar contributions from people around the state in order to qualify. And it looks as if, unfortunately, he will not be qualifying for the public financing system. But we don't believe that that's indicative of anything other than the fact that currently, in a somewhat cynical move, our leaders in Albany set up the system in a way that was designed to fail. We know from other races and other places that a properly calibrated public financing system can be very effective, and as I think the New York City maps show, can have the impact that we want of bringing small dollar donors to the fore, putting voters first, not special interests. So I'd like to talk to you about another aspect of our elections that often gets overlooked, and that is redistricting, and why it's important, and why there's an important proposal on the ballot in November. And redistricting, as you may know, is the process of setting political boundary lines. It's map drawing, basically, to determine which districts, the boundary lines for districts for primary for legislative offices. And it can have significant impacts on who is willing to run, on who the winners are, and who is represented, and the political power of communities. If communities are divided, it's difficult for them to gain political power, difficult for them to gain the attention of their elected representatives. If communities, if particular communities of interest are packed together, then perhaps they're denied the ability to have an influence in a larger number of districts. I learned about the consequences of this in the first presentation that I gave, actually, in New York City on redistricting to a community down in South Brooklyn that has a very strong identity, a community called Bay Ridge. And when I started to talk about redistricting, several of the members of the audience stood up and said, "You don't understand how it really works. We're an example of the worst part of it. Our neighborhood is cut between 7 different assembly districts. And as a consequence, it's impossible for us to get all 7 of these people to agree to the things that we feel our community needs." And that's a very basic, I think, lesson about redistricting. When only small parts of the community are represented, the elected representative has so many people to pay attention to that they don't focus in on the community which only a small sliver is represented. So it has a real-world consequence, but it is, frankly, a wonky topic and one that can cause people's eyes to glaze over. And so what I'm going to try and do is show you how it works without getting too far into the weeds and losing you. Let's see if we can get this. Okay, so what we have here is a model of, let's say, you know, a simplified model of a community. And we have 15 circles and we have 12 triangles. So the challenge to the people who are drawing the map is how to set up a map of political boundary lines that is fair, that gives each of these individuals, we're going to say each of these shapes represents a voter, a fair opportunity to represent to elect a representative of their choice. Here's one way to do it. If you do it this way, it's very proportional. And you see that the 15 circles will elect 2 circles, and we're assuming here that each circle elects a circle representative and each triangle will vote for a triangle representative. In the real world, it's a little more complicated than that. But for the sake of argument, let's say that everybody votes their shape. This gives you a straight proportional representation that mimics and reflects the actual numbers of circles and triangles. But let's say that somebody else has the pencil. What's our result? 15 blue circles. They're all circles. So who do we think probably is in control of drawing these lines? Probably going to be the circles. There's yet another way to do this. This is what makes map making so incredibly interesting. Same distribution of your circles and your triangles. Another approach. What are we going to get here? triangles. And that's why map drawing and the way in which we approach it is important. I think this has been, we got this little animation from one of our colleagues down in New York City, and I think it's the clearest illustration that I've been able to come up with of why this is important and how it can change the landscape. So good government advocates have been advocating for quite some time for reforming the redistricting process in Albany, which currently is controlled by the legislature. And what we've seen in the redistricting process is not so much that Democrats or Republicans, one party or another, behaves in a particular way. What we've seen is that incumbent legislators are concerned first and foremost with districts which will be comfortable for them. And it's a system where all too often elected representatives and the political parties, we believe, collude against the voters. A lot of energy in 2011, 2010 and 2011 to reform this process. And Common Cause, some of you may recall, drew nonpartisan, non-politicized reform maps in order to show that it could be done. And in order to do that, we started with a map of the state, and we started with the census data, and we did our best to apply fair redistricting principles to come up with a map that reflects how New Yorkers actually live and associate and how that should be reflected in political districts. The important part for us was starting with a clean map. We did not start with the districts as they exist, because it's widely recognized that New York's legislative districts have been gerrymandered to the benefit of the incumbents to maintain the political control of the houses of the legislature that has existed for the past, I think it's 30 or 40 years without a break, except in one small instance. So what we have, unfortunately, what happened in 2012 was that as part of a package deal that was negotiated behind closed doors, the governor went back on his word that he would veto gerrymandered maps, and as part of that deal, approved maps which are widely accepted as being politicized and not fair and impartial redistricting, and as part of that deal also agreed to a constitutional amendment which is going to be on our ballot. And after analysis of the amendment, we have some very, very significant concerns about it, and we believe it should not be adopted by the voters. So I'd like to briefly explain what's in it and then tell you what our concerns are. It sets up a system with a commission that is appointed in major part directly by the legislature. And the redistricting plans which it would draw are subject to approval by the legislature. And it has a provision in it which in my experience is absolutely unique. And because it's so difficult to understand and sometimes difficult to explain, I've actually put together a handout about it, and it's on the back of complicated voting rules guarantee partisan control. I'm not going to go through it in detail. If you're interested, you've got all the detail here. But in essence, what it does is it sets up changing rules, rules that are different for how the commission will do its business depending on political control of the two houses of the legislature. If the houses are controlled by one party, the rules are X. If the houses are controlled by two parties, the rules are Y. And our big concern with this amendment is that rather than getting us closer to where we all want to be, which is a fair and impartial redistricting, this system locks in political control in a particularly bold way, we believe, a real power grab on the part of the powers that be as part of a deal that was negotiated behind closed doors in which there were no hearings on what was going to be proposed and no ability to change it. That in and of itself is problematic, but most problematic is the fact that this sort of partisan control, if Prop 1 would pass, is being written into our state constitution. Our state constitution has provisions dealing with redistricting, which badly need to be redone. Does anybody know when our state constitution's redistricting provisions were written into the Constitution? 1894. Anybody want to venture a guess the last time they were actually amended? 1945. So when you write something into your state constitution, it's not something that you go back and you adjust and you jigger and you are able to improve in an incremental fashion. It is big change, and we need to get it right. Our current provisions of the Constitution for redistricting, as I said, are far from perfect, but what they do not do is they do not require partisan control of redistricting. They may allow it, but they don't require it. And we believe that the language of Prop 1 makes partisan control a mandatory requirement. And that's not a direction that we believe our Constitution should go in. If you try and read the constitutional amendment, you'll find that it's very complicated. And if you then read it in the context of the rest of the existing provision for redistricting, you'll find it's even more confusing because the provisions contradict each other. Unfortunately, we believe that that is deliberate. It's done to throw the issue into the courts and then to allow the courts to use the standard that they have established over the last several decades, which is deference to the legislature. And remember, I said that one of the things that we felt was important at Common Cause was to be able to start drawing the maps from a clean page. The redistricting criteria in Prop 1 allow the map makers to start with the current districts and, in fact, encourage them not to change the current districts. Our experience is when you start with a gerrymandered district, you end up with a gerrymandered district. And any map maker that starts with a clean page is going to find a criteria in the amendment which would push them back into the current map. We don't want to see the current map memorialized and continued for decades to come. The commission itself was originally described as independent. And there was a description that the Board of Elections was going to put on the ballot saying that Prop 1 would set up an independent commission. At Common Cause, we felt that that was not a fair description of what the commission was, and we felt strongly enough about it that we organized four voters, and I personally was one of them, to sue the Board of Elections to ensure that the voters were not misled with an unfair description of what the commission is. And a state court judge last month, a state court judge in Albany, heard our petition and agreed with us. The commission that Prop 1 would set up cannot fairly be described as independent. To describe it that way would be misleading. The judge also ruled that if the proposition were in place, the commission's work could be completely ignored by the legislature, which could then take back the entire process and draw any maps that it chose. So we have some of the state court's findings. Commission can't be described as independent. Oh, and I talked about those shifting voting rules. The judge was really surprised by that. His description: the court is not aware of any other law in New York State that has ever required a commission or any other legislative body's vote approval to be dependent on the political makeup of the legislature. Again, this is enshrining, memorializing direct political control in our state constitution, where we at Common Cause strongly believe it does not belong. Not for redistricting, not for election administration, not for ethics oversight. So to us, this has consequences beyond just how will redistricting be conducted. It's really a philosophical approach. We believe that our state government should be as impartial as reasonable, that our elected representatives should represent everybody, and that there should not be a bias for or against any political party and its control on any issue, but that the first responsibility should be, as I titled my presentation, voters first, not political parties. Okay. And that's why we come to the conclusion that Prop 1 is actually worse than doing nothing, because it takes us in a direction and places partisan control ingrained in our state constitution, where history shows we will not be able to revise it, change it for decades, if not a century, to come. If what we want is responsive state government that fairly represents all New Yorkers, then we believe that Prop 1 should be rejected by the voters. And it's not just the judge who believes that this is not an independent commission and that the commission's work could be completely ignored by the legislature, and then we're back where we started. But ed boards across the state, having looked at the details of Prop 1, also are urging the voters to reject it. Here, the Syracuse Post-Standard has editorialized recently about Prop 1. They share our concerns. As you can see, the Albany Times Union shares our concerns, the New York Times, and there are additional newspapers across the state. So you don't have to rely just on what Common Cause is interpreting. There are a number of impartial voices which have come out strongly against Prop 1. We can do better, and on redistricting, we have the time to do better. Redistricting is not going to happen again until 2022. So we don't have to settle for what even its proponents admit is a flawed system. We don't have to lock partisan control into our state constitution. The truth of the matter is that between now and 2022, there are going to be three different men in the room, three different leaders in the room. And that will give us an opportunity to get this right. If what we want is incremental change to get us closer and closer to impartial redistricting, then we can do that by statute. We can try out different systems, and then we can adopt a system that will work for all New Yorkers and that won't put political parties and incumbents in control. And I would be happy to take questions.
Hi, before I came here 6 years ago, I was in California, and I'm aware that in California, it happened right as I left, they now have an independent redistricting commission, and there's this new system, I think it's called First Two Past the Post or something of that nature, where Basically the primary system has been eliminated, and it's the two top vote getters that end up going to the final election. So I'm just curious if you have any comments about that, and if you've seen any trends in other states adopting those models, because they seemed like they took out all the gerrymandering aspects of the redistricting, because it was an independent commission. You didn't have, it was all based on political boundaries.
That's right.
I think I failed to mention that Susan actually worked in California before she came to New York, so
I
hopefully
did.
She's aware of it.
I am very aware of it, and I'm happy to say that my colleague in California, California Common Cause, was a major drafter of the initiative that set up the independent commission. But what people don't know is that it's not just California that has a truly citizen-driven independent commission. Ulster County here in New York State did exactly something very similar for its 2012 redistricting process. It set up an independent commission made up of citizens, not legislators, not lobbyists, not chosen by the legislature, the county legislature. And they drew a fair map that was impartial, that accurately represents the communities that make up Ulster. And Democrats and Republicans from the county legislature and the county executive all agreed that this was a fair and successful process that happened efficiently and on time. It can be done. It's not just California. It can be adopted here in New York by a legislature, by a charter revision commission, and we see how it works. Austin, Texas uses a similar system. Basically, what happens is that ordinary citizens volunteer to be part of the commission. And in California, the first step to being considered, because you don't automatically get on, there is a process for determining whether people have the necessary skills to be part of the commission. But it was opened up to the public to take the first step of the application, and it was a website where you answered 6 questions about your background. We expected to get a reasonable turnout, 4,000 or 5,000 people on a statewide basis who would be interested in being in the commission. We were stunned. More than 30,000 Californians went to the website and answered the questions. You give people an opportunity to directly participate, they will step forward. One of the problems with our system is we don't have enough invitations to people to become actively involved the way the people in this room are actively involved.
Thank you very much for your terrific analysis and presentation. I'm sure we're all grateful. The beginning of your talk pointed out that there was simply too much money in elections. And then the answer that you gave was more money. And I wonder if Common Cause is looking at the symmetrical or the anti-symmetrical side, namely less money by the big spenders.
Well, one of the reasons why we recommend the fair election system is that actually, while you can look at it as putting more money into the system, what it actually does is it brings down the amount of money because it focuses on the small dollar contributor. And in the system, because I went through very quickly, I didn't get into all of the interstitial details, the system also has a spending cap for participants. Okay, there's not a blank check that's being written with public money. There's very significant limits, and that's why we believe it's also important that non-participants should be subject to lower dollar limits as well. So what we've seen in New York City is that it helps to hold down the costs, the direct costs, the candidate costs of elections. There's a whole other talk that I could give about Citizens United and independent spenders and dark money, but that's for another time. Ask me back. I'd love to talk to you about it.
Yeah, I too appreciated your illuminating presentation on a wonky topic. But a question on campaign finance reform. The other day, I saw an ad in the Maffei-Katko race where one side was attacking the other side for its negative ads. It's the first... It's the first double negative ad, I think, of the campaign. Can campaign finance reform get to negative advertising, and has it perhaps done that in New York City?
It's an interesting, now we're getting back into the dark money phenomenon, because what's very interesting about the explosion of independent non-candidate ads is that what we're seeing is that the independent non-candidate ads often from committees that have great names like Puppies Who Love Dan Maffei. I'm being satiric here, okay? That those speakers who aren't obvious to the voters, the negative ads in large proportion are coming from the outside spenders. That allows the candidates to be insulated. Well, I didn't say anything bad about my opponent. These people that I'm independent from, who may also include somebody who used to run my campaign and may also be run by my political consultant, I wouldn't say anything negative. But to answer your question, we have something unique in the United States, which I think is absolutely central to our system. But it has negatives and positives, and that's the First Amendment. We have freedom of speech. In Western Europe, where they do not have freedom of speech built into their system as a guaranteed right, or in England, there are different restrictions. Their campaign season is 6 weeks. A lot of people would like that here. The amount of money is significantly curtailed because in the parliamentary system, in the representational system, it comes solely through the parties or from public places. And how what they're allowed to say is also regulated. I think that's too high a cost to get around the First Amendment. And some of the consequences of that are some of the negative campaigning that we see. So it's a balancing act. And I think many people would be very uncomfortable with government saying you can say this, but you can't say that in your campaign ad. So that's why it's important for people like you to let the candidates know and the outside spenders, we really dislike this. We're not responsive. Campaigns will continue to negatively advertise if it continues to move voters. When it stops moving voters, we'll stop seeing it.
I go back to the campaign finance, and I know it was just brought up about the Citizen United independent expenditures, and you kind of said that's for another time, but really it's relevant here because just having that one decision by the Supreme Court kind of blows out any basis for doing much with government financing, I guess, really what we're saying here. And so no matter what you do, if you could have independent expenditures that can spend anything they want in any way they want without much people even knowing who's giving it, it's a whole different ballgame. So I'd be interested in getting a little more from you on that.
Sure.
The other flip side of also a different question is the government financing, in essence. It is going to be a significant cost, even if it may lower ultimately cost of everything. Now the government is putting out a lot of money. We all know the times we've been in, particularly the last 5-6 years, money is at a premium, priorities, issues. To give it to this, is that the right answer?
Okay. So two questions. Let me take the first one. Number one, we really need to strengthen our disclosure laws in relation to the dark money. That's a part of what I think is important and that we need to keep as a goal. But when we're looking at a situation where there are a lot of outside spenders, the fair election system is actually the strongest protection and the strongest system to help a candidate communicate their point of view to the voters. Because it's the unfortunate fact that when you have a large outside spender, often the larger contributors are discouraged. They don't want to go into a money race if there is a committee that's coming in with $1 or $2 million. The grassroots, on the other hand, can be very motivated by the fact that some Washington organization or an organization that has a post office box in Arlington, Virginia is the only thing you can find out about them, is coming into our local area and is going to drop $1.5 million. Well, I'm going to step forward with my $25 and $50, which is matched by the public, to allow the candidate, him or herself, to communicate with the voters. So we believe, actually, that the fair election system is even more important and even more necessary in a situation where we have these out-of-control independent expenditures, and that it is the first defense which a candidate can have while we work as Common Cause and many of its partners are working to amend the federal constitution, the U.S. Constitution, to allow control for the outside spending. As far as determining where resources should go, the truth of the matter is that the large campaign spending has an everyday cost to all of us. In terms of public policies that are driven more by the concerns of large special interest donors than they are by ordinary everyday New Yorkers, we're paying for it one way or the other. And at Common Cause, we believe that we should be paying directly in a way where we can control it, where we can be sure that the recipients of the money are using it well and are using it in a way that will benefit all of us. So one way or another, we pay. We either pay with higher consumer costs, where the money is then being used for campaigns, or we pay in public policies that are allowing for public spending that benefits some but not all.
I don't have so much a question as an observation. Onondaga County has a population of about 470,000 people. In a county legislature at this time, one party has, out of the 17 seats, has, 13 of them. And the other party, a minority party, has four. I would suggest that if there's a Hall of Fame for people who do gerrymandering, I would nominate the Onondaga County Legislature.
Unfortunately, there are a lot of county legislators that are in contesting for that particular prize. We did a report, actually, with our colleagues in Nassau County, which we call the Voters First Report, and we have it up on the web, and it allows you to go through and look at redistricting for all of the counties here in New York to see which are the failed models, of which, unfortunately, we have way too many, and which are the ones that worked, which, frankly, is Ulster. But you can find that on the NassauUnitedRedistricting.org website.
All right. I probably should have said this at the very start of the program, but any comments are solely the opinions of the speaker or the questioner and do not reflect on whether it's about a candidate or a ballot issue. Do not reflect the opinions of Thursday Morning Roundtable or University College. So that,
that's
definitely true of every program that we do within which anyone is stating their opinion. But I just should make that clear. Joe.
And I do want to wrap up by saying if you would like more information about the No on Prop 1 campaign, you can go to our website, which is Prop 1, No Prop 1. That's the number one, ny.com.
All right. I'm going to give Joan Johnson with the League of Women Voters the final question.
Okay. Susan, it's great to see you. The League has worked with you and your organization for years. Unfortunately, we do not agree on this issue. I'm not going to go into the reasons why, but I have one specific question for you. We've been trying for 50 years to get redistricting reform in this state. How do you think it's going to happen before 2022? I mean, we worked with you during the last census period. It went nowhere. I'm afraid if we don't support this, the legislators are going to turn to us and they're going to say, well, they voted no. They're happy with the status quo. And this will be the end of it, probably in our lifetime, everyone in this room and probably our children and our grandchildren.
So we do, you know, respectfully disagree in that. Number one, we did get some redistricting reform the last cycle, and that was to deal with a problem that we call prison-based gerrymandering. But most importantly, I think that the legislators will understand the voters' logic, because newspapers across the state are telling them why the voters are rejecting Prop 1. And I think it's important for us to be able to distinguish what belongs in our Constitution and what doesn't. It will give us a very strong platform to go back to the legislators and say there is a strong push for getting it right. The voters have spoken. Let's do what we need to do between now and 2022. As I said, with most likely a very different set of people, the top three in the room that we'll be able to work with. So I believe that we absolutely can do it, and we're in a stronger position to get real reform when we call out what I believe is a cynical attempt to lock in the current system and make it seem like reform.
Hang on a second.
At our website, it's down at the bottom in black to learn why we are supporting this amendment. It's not perfect. It's www.voteyesforprogress.org. Right in the bottom of here, and it's not a perfect solution, but perfection doesn't come all of a sudden. It comes step by step, and we feel this is the only thing we've seen in a long, long time, and it's worth giving it a try.
So we'll have lots of decisions to be making on November 4th. Again, I want to remind you that Tuesday, October 21st, 5 p.m. at the Liverpool Library. Check out both of those websites. Read what you can in the media. Susan Lerner of Common Cause New York, thanks for coming up this morning.
Thank you very much.